So going back to that idea of our progression through mortality, every temple that's ever existed, modern and ancient, has presented two phases of our journey through mortality. And what got lost, one of the things that got lost in the apostasy is the expectation of where the journey ends. I remind you that our temples present the idea that there is, in this world in which we live, a whole telestial component. It's like we are living in the telestial room. And some of our early temples in this dispensation actually had a telestial room. And as our journey into Heavenly Father's presence, we have to journey through the telestial room. So here we are in the telestial world, being tempted with all sorts of telestial things. Now, almost everyone in the world who lives up to that conscience inside them knows I'm not supposed to be telestial. The moral code inside of us says, I need to be better than telestial. And so even if you just follow the moral code inside of you, you know you have to make this transition. You know you have to get out of the telestial room, leave everything telestial behind, and get into the terrestrial room. That, I think, is what every religion all over this planet teaches clearly. Get out of the telestial room. Leave telestial things behind. Tim.
If we don't follow the moral code that we all have, does that mean we are telestial?
Yes, we're all telestial, right? We're all struggling. Now, to the degree to which you follow the moral code, you're letting go of the telestial. But let's remember, no one is going to fully become terrestrial or even less celestial in this life. And I love that C.S. Lewis is even going to address that tonight. Death is an important part of that. He caught that. So don't simply say you have to be, there is no expectation that I have to be all celestial now. It's just not going to happen. But the process of letting go, and I would dare say most of us expect that in religion. I would say everyone expects my religion to tell me to be a good person. But this is what not very many people catch and was restored in the restoration. One of the great opening of our eyes that the restoration has brought is that if we continue to follow Christ, He is going to make a whole nother change. As beautiful as the terrestrial world is, it is not our destination. And if anyone thinks that the destination is goodness, or like we'll talk about tonight, niceness, I want people to be nice to me, and you're not very nice, so you haven't hit the destination. The destination is that we're all nice. If you think the destination is niceness or kindness or goodness, you have not caught the vision of where Christ is trying to take you. The goal is not niceness. Now, if that is your goal, there's an entire kingdom Heavenly Father has for you, and you'll be very happy in that kingdom. But if you are going to hitch your wagon to Christ, you need to understand He is going to take you to a very, very different place. If you thought niceness was the goal, you are in for a shock. So, let's go back to last week. Let's go back to chapter 9, which I didn't mark because we read the whole chapter. Where is it? Okay, here we go. Okay, let's start here. On the other hand, you must realize from the outset that the goal towards which He is beginning to guide you is absolute perfection. And no power in the whole universe except you yourself can prevent Him from taking you to that goal. That is what you are in for. And it is very important to realize that. If you do not, then you are very likely to start pulling back and resisting him after a certain point. Let me just reread this. I think that many of us, when Christ has enabled us to overcome one or two sins that were an obvious nuisance, are inclined to feel, though we do not put it into words, that we are now good enough. Some of you are lifelong members of the church. You've been committed to goodness your whole life. You come home from your mission. And what is the expectation? I am a return missionary. I should expect things to go fairly smoothly now. Wrong. You still have terrestrial rats in your cellar, and he has to show you that they're there. If niceness was the goal, he would leave you alone. But niceness is not the goal. He has done all that we wanted him to do, and we should now be obliged if he would now leave us alone. Forgive me for being blunt, but some of you come home from your missions thinking he's going to leave you alone. He's not. As we say, I never expected to be a saint. I only wanted to be a decent, ordinary chap. And we imagine that when we say this, we're being humble. But that is a fatal mistake. And the answer is we don't fully appreciate where he's taking me. And the goal is not niceness. The goal is not goodness. The goal is a complete change all the way down to the inner part of me. He is making me into what he is. That was the point we made last week. Now, let's go to chapter 10. Are you okay if I just read a lot? I just want you to hear it from C.S. Lewis, so allow me to read. But I've marked it this time because we're not going to read the whole chapter. He begins with a fascinating idea that shows the misunderstanding that most people have with religion. If Christianity is true, why are not all Christians obviously nicer than all non-Christians? That is a brilliant question that shows a fundamental flaw. If Mormonism is true, why are not all Mormons obviously nicer than all non-Mormons? As if the goal is what? Niceness. It is not. Now, he's going to answer that in several ways. What lies behind that question is partly something very reasonable and partly something that is not reasonable at all. The reasonable part is this, and allow me to shout this from the rooftops. If conversion to Christianity, allow me to use Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, makes no improvement in a man's outward actions, if he continues to be just as snobbish or spiteful or envious or ambitious as he was before, then I think we must suspect that his conversion was largely imaginary. And after one's original conversion, every time one thinks one has made an advance, that is the test to apply. Do you think there are imaginary Mormons in the church? Fine feelings, new insights, great interest in religion mean nothing unless they make our actual behavior better. Just as in an illness, feeling better is not much good if the thermometer shows your temperature is still going up. In that sense, the outer world is quite right to judge Christianity by its results. Christ told us to judge by results. A tree is known by its fruit. Or as we say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. When we Christians behave badly, when we members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints behave badly or fail to behave well, we are making Christianity unbelievable to the outside world. The wartime posters told us that careless talk costs lives. It is equally true that careless lives cost talk. That's a brilliant concept. Alma told his son Corianton, when they saw your conduct, they would not believe my words. Our careless lives set the outer world talking, and we give them grounds for talking in a way that throws doubt on the truth of Christianity itself. I think we all need to remember that. Now he says, the other way that question is not quite right, and he talks about two concepts. Let me just briefly summarize. Number one, he says, the question is, why aren't Christians nicer than non-Christians? And he says, you can't split the world into two because there are a lot of Christians that aren't Christians. And there are a lot of people in the world that are very much Christian, even though they don't call themselves Christian. That is not a fair separation. Are there good people who are not members of Christianity or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, don't claim Christianity, and yet they're very good, but they appeal to the ideas that Christ taught, but don't carry the title of Christianity? And are there people who carry the title of Christianity who don't live the ideals of Jesus? It's not very fair to say, why are all Christians not better than all non-Christians? Then number two, which I would love to read, but we're just not. He says, the test is John better than Joe? Is the member of the church, John, better than the non-member of the church, Joe? The question is new John better than old John? Is new Joe, if John's the Christian, is he better than the non-Christian John would be? And is Joe the non-Christian, would Christianity make him a better person than he is? That's the real test, not John versus Joe. Brilliant number two. It's number three that I want to talk about. And this whole question, why aren't Christians nicer than non-Christians? It's because you don't understand the point of Christianity. Niceness is not the goal. If niceness is the goal, then we can compare where are we on towards the goal. But niceness is not the goal. And C.S. Lewis caught that. So he says, now let's go a little deeper. Before Christ has finished with... Now, he's using two people. Let me introduce them to you. Dick Firkin and Miss Bates. So Christian Miss Bates and unbelieving Dick Firkin. Before Christ has finished with Miss Bates, she is going to be very nice indeed. But if we left it at that, it would sound as though Christ's only aim was to pull Miss Bates up to the same level on which Dick had been all along. We have been talking, in fact, as if Dick were all right, as if Christianity were something nasty people needed and nice ones could afford to do without. Now, forgive me, again, for being blunt. How many good people out there say, I don't need religion because I'm good? I don't need religion because I'm good. That's the misunderstanding. I'm going to say that again. As if Christianity was something that nasty people needed and nice ones could afford to do without. And as if niceness was all that God demanded. But this would be a fatal mistake. The truth is that in God's eyes, Dick Firkin needs saving every bit as much as Miss Bates. In one sense, I will explain that sense in a moment, niceness hardly comes into the question. You cannot expect God to look at Dick's placid temper and friendly disposition exactly as we do. The result from natural causes which God himself creates. Being merely temperamental, they will all disappear if Dick's digestion alters. The niceness, in fact, is God's gift to Dick, not Dick's gift to God. In the same way, God has allowed natural causes working in a world spoiled by centuries of sin to produce in Miss Bates the narrow mind and jangled nerves which account for most of her nastiness. He intends, in his own good time, to set that part of her right. He's going to fix her nastiness, isn't he? But is the goal simply to fix her nastiness? But that is not for God the critical part of the business. It presents no difficulties. It is not what he is anxious about. What he is watching and waiting and working for, something that is not easy even for God. Because from the nature of the case, even he cannot produce it by a mere act of power. Tell me the one thing that God wants from you. Tell me the one thing he can't take from you. If he takes it, he ceases to be God. He gave me my money, he can take it, no problem. He gave me my life, he can take it, no problem. He gave me my mental abilities, he can take it, no problem. But there is one thing he gave me that he cannot take from me, and it's the only thing he wants from me. He is waiting and watching for it both in Miss Bates and Dick Firkin. It is something they can freely give him or freely refuse to him. They will or they will not turn to him and thus fulfill the only purpose for which they were created. Their free will is trembling inside them like the needle of a compass. But this is a needle that can choose. It can point to its true north, but it need not. Will the needle swing around and settle and point to God? He can help it do so. He cannot force it. He cannot, so to speak, put his own hand and pull it into the right position. For then it would not be free will anymore. Will it point north? That is the question on which all hangs. Will Miss Bates and Dick offer their natures to God? The question whether the natures they offer or withhold are at that moment nice or nasty ones is of secondary importance. Does it matter if one's nice and one's nasty? No, because he's not going for that. God can see that. God can see to that part of the problem. Do not misunderstand me. Of course, God regards a nasty nature as a bad and deplorable thing. And of course, he regards a nice nature as a good thing. Good like bread or sunshine or water. But these are the good things which he gives and we receive. He created Dick's sound nerves and good digestion, and there's plenty more where they came from. It costs God nothing, as far as we know, to create nice things. But to convert rebellious wills cost his crucifixion. And because they are wills, they can, in nice people just as much as in nasty ones, refuse his request. And then because of that nastiness in Dick was merely part of a nature, it will all go to pieces in the end. Nature herself will all pass away. Natural causes come together in Dick to make a pleasant psychological pattern, just as they come together in a sunset to make a pleasant pattern of color. Presently, for that is how nature works, they will fall apart again, and the pattern in both places will disappear. Dick has had the chance to turn, or rather to allow God to turn that momentary pattern into the beauty of an eternal spirit. And he has not taken it. Now there's a paradox here. As long as Dick does not turn to God, he thinks his niceness is his own. And just as long as he thinks that, it is not his own. It is when Dick realizes that his niceness is not his own, but a gift from God, and when he offers it back to God, it is just then that it begins to be really his own. For now, Dick is beginning to take a share in his own creation. The only things we can keep are the things we freely give to God. What we try to keep for ourselves is just what we are sure to lose. We all need to process that. The only things we keep are the things we freely give to God. What we are trying to keep for ourselves is just what we are sure to lose. We must therefore not be surprised if we find among the Christians some people who are still nasty. There is even, when you come to think it over, a reason why nasty people might be expected to turn to Christ in greater numbers than nice ones. Shouldn't there be more nasty members of the church than nice members? Because nasty people need Christ. But there's again the misconception. That was what people objected to about Christ during his life on earth. He seemed to attract such awful people. That is what people still object to and always will. Do you see why? Christ said, "Blessed are the poor," and how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom. And no doubt he primarily meant the economically rich and the economically poor. But do not his words also apply to another kind of riches and poverty? One of the dangers of having a lot of money is that you may be quite satisfied with the kinds of happiness money can give, and so fail to realize your money for God, your need for God. If everything seems to come simply by signing checks, you guys don't know what that means, do you? Has anyone in here signed a check besides a handful of us? If everything seems to come simply by signing checks, you may forget that you are at every moment totally dependent on God. Now, quite plainly, natural gifts carry with them a similar danger. If you have sound nerves and intelligence and health and popularity and a good upbringing, you are likely to be quite satisfied with your character as it is. Why drag God into it, you may ask? A certain level of good conduct comes fairly easily to you. You are not one of those wretched creatures who are always being tripped up by sex, dipsomania, nervousness, or bad temper. Everyone says you're a nice chap, and between yourselves, you agree with them. You are quite likely to believe that all this niceness is your own doing. And you may easily not feel the need for any better kind of goodness. Often people who have all these natural kind of goodnesses cannot be brought to recognize their need for Christ at all. Until one day, the natural goodness lets them down and their self-satisfaction is shattered. In other words, it is hard for those who are rich in this sense to enter the kingdom. Ouch, that is... People born and raised in the church who just think they're good. I'm good. I've been a member all my life. Easy to do. It is very different for nasty people. The little, low, timid, warped, thin-blooded, lonely people, or the passionate, sensual, unbalanced people. If they make any attempt at goodness at all, they learn in double quick time that they need help. It is Christ or nothing for them. It is taking up the cross or following or else despair. They are the lost sheep. He came specially to find them. They are, in one very real and terrible sense, the poor. He blessed them. They are the awful set he goes about with. And of course, the Pharisees will still say, that, as they said from the first, if there were anything in Christianity, those people would not be Christians. There is either a warning or an encouragement here for every one of us. If you are a nice person, if virtue comes easily to you, you better watch out. Much is expected from those to whom much is given. If you mistake for your own merits what are really God's gifts to you through nature, if you are contented with simply being nice, you are still a rebel. And all those gifts will only make your fall more terrible, more corruption, more complicated, more bad example, more disastrous. The devil was an archangel once. His natural gifts were as far above yours as yours are above of a chimpanzee. But if you are a poor creature, poisoned by a wretched upbringing in some house full of vulgar jealousies and senseless squirrels, saddled by no choice of your own with some loathsome sexual perversion, nagged day in and day out by an inferiority complex that makes you snap at your best friends, don't despair. He knows all about it. You are one of the poor whom he blessed. He knows what a wretched machine you are trying to drive. Keep on. Do what you can. One day, perhaps in another world, but perhaps far sooner than that, he will fling it on the scrap heap and give you a new one. And then you may astonish us all, not least yourself, for you have learned your driving in a hard school. Some of the last will be first, and some of the first will be last. Niceness, wholesomeness, integrated personality is an excellent thing. We must try by every medical, educational, economic, and political means in our power to produce a world where many people as possible grow up nice. Just as we must try to produce a world where all have plenty to eat. But we must not suppose that even if we succeeded in making everyone nice, we should have saved their souls. A world of nice people, content in their own niceness, looks no further, turned away from God, would be just as desperately in need of salvation as a miserable world, and might even be more difficult to save. For mere improvement is not redemption. Let me say that again. Mere improvement is not redemption. It's not making you better, he's after. It's not making you nice. Though redemption always improves people, even here and now, and will in the end improve them to a degree you cannot yet imagine. God became man to turn creatures into sons. Not simply to produce better men of the old kind, but to produce a new kind of man. It is not like teaching a horse to jump better and better, but like turning a horse into a winged creature. Of course, once it has got its wings, it will soar over fences which could never have been jumped and thus beat the natural horse at its own game. But there may be a period while the wings are just beginning to grow, when it cannot do so. And at that stage, the lumps on the shoulders, no one could tell by looking at them that they're going to be wings, may even give it an awkward appearance. Do you take that like I do? He is not after niceness. And in fact, if you have become content in your niceness, you are in trouble. If you have become content in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because you go to church and you do what's right and you're a good person, you are in trouble. Niceness is not the goal. And the problem is, you might be so content with your niceness that you're actually interfering with the goal. Because you're good, because you're kind, because you're nice, because you don't hurt people, you might actually be a bigger problem for God to help than the rebel who knows he needs God. We have got to get it in our heads that niceness is not the goal. And because I'm nice, I must never be content that I can sit back and just be a good member of the church. Niceness might actually be the enemy to my progression if I think it's the goal.
Is this similar to the of the Lord's, I mean, the man in his vineyard, after he finishes work, he retires and he dies.
And he builds bigger, the one that builds his barn bigger,
yeah.
And then he dies and loses it all. I think, yeah, I can see the connection. This is a hard chapter for me to read. I hope it's a hard chapter for you to hear, because sometimes I sit back in my niceness and say, I'm doing great, Lord, you go work on him. And the Lord's probably up there saying, you're the one I need to work on the most. You are letting your niceness interfere with your progression. Because both nice and nasty, the goal is to change everything about you. I don't need a faster horse. I need a horse with wings. And a horse that simply thinks fast is the goal is going to resist the wings. This chapter always haunts me, and I think it's supposed to haunt me. It's supposed to invite me to have an urgency about my converting to a little to Christ, and to not be content with my niceness. Shannon.
I feel like every time I listen or read to this chapter, like you said, it's kind of like it either severely calls me out, or it like is a huge comfort to me, because sometimes I'm the one that's, like, I can see both sides of it.
Yep. Sometimes I'm the rebel that needs him desperately.
Exactly. And so when I feel like I'm doing my very hardest, I love that section that talks about how, you know, I get so frustrated with myself, and when I'm being impatient with myself, then I recognize, like, you know, it's more about not being a rebel. It's more about the fact that I am turning to God. And just because, you know, I struggle with this temptation or that temptation, it doesn't disqualify me, because God knows the temptations that I have, and that probably has a lot more to do just with my brain chemistry than it does with my soul and what I actually want.
Yep.
And so, I don't know.
Bless your soul.
I love this chapter.
I love how C.S. Lewis at one point, I don't think it's Mere Christianity, I think it's It is. Dang it. He says in chapter 7, in chapter 4, fallen man is not simply an imperfect creature who needs improvement. He is a rebel who must lay down his arms. Any other thoughts? Tell me I'm not the only one. That's just, this chapter just gets to, please. Yeah.
You know, like I think we've, you know, there's personally, and I'm sure everybody's had a couple of these moments where you really just feel like you just need God, and then there's other moments where you just are like, I should have been nice in that moment.
Yep. You got it. And there's the balance, right? There are moments where I'm slipping into the telestial and I need to just be nicer. There are moments I need to tell myself, I just need to be nicer. But then there's other moments I need to tell myself, no, the goal is not niceness. And if I stop the urgency to progress because I've hit niceness, I've missed the goal. But then every day I have little reminders, oh, I need to be nicer. Oh, I'm slipping. I need to be nicer. So yes, I need to work on niceness. There's no question. I need to work on niceness. When the guy cuts me off on the freeway, I need to work on niceness. But I can't be content to think that niceness is the goal, and to stop the urgency of wanting Christ to change me. Tim.
I think the solution is never to become complacent. Because once you're like, oh, I'm good, I can stop working on this for now, when you're complacent, that's when you start slipping backwards.
Isn't it fascinating that Nephi's going to tell us in 2 Nephi, one of the great obstacles to our day is he lulls them into carnal security and says, all is well in Zion. It's that contentment. I'm a good member of the church. I'm just going to bask in my goodness. And then all of a sudden, I get a glimpse of a rat in my cellar. And I remind myself, it's my contentment to my goodness that might be the biggest problem of my life.
So, how, I guess, how can you, when you have chapters like these, how do you stop from feeling like the worst failure ever to actually... Wait, no, I'm not. I can just work on this.
You don't say, I'm not. You say, I am the worst failure ever. Jesus, come save me. And that's the moment where he can really begin to work on you when you say, Lord, I can't do this. I can't do this. And that's the moment where we turn to him and give him the one thing that he can't take from us. Lord, I'm yours, and wherever you take me, I'll go. It's the recognition that I am a rebellious creature. And Lord, if you don't take the sword out of my hand, I don't know if I'll ever be able to put it down. It's exactly the moment where you have to say, I can't do it without him. So you open up your hymn book and you sing, I need thee every hour. Every hour, I need thee. Oh Lord, I need thee. And you give him the one thing he can't take. And my will to follow you. Shannon.
And I also want to bring up this poem from last time, that God is easy to please and hard to satisfy.
Yeah.
Because God is going to be very pleased with everything that you're
every doing. Step I take.
Every thought that you even try to make better, he's very pleased with you in that. But like, he's going to take you further and further and push you further and further. And then the other thought that I had is just that, like, it's not just, you know, we become content with our own goodness, but we become content with good circumstances too.
Yep.
And it just reminds me of the Nephites, because they're like, hey, everything's good. Don't need you anymore, Lord. Go ahead and leave us alone now. But then it falls over on them, because anything that we don't give to God is going to go away.
What's that verse in the book of, why am I drawing a blank, that said they had been so long in a peaceful state, they hadn't been stirred up to wars or anger, that they'd just kind of become content.
Yeah. And then that pushes you to think, okay, if this is good, what does God have better?
Yeah. Too? Beautiful. Tim?
I think it's important, because to stop you from getting overwhelmed, you just focus on the next step. Like, if you're walking up a ridiculously long staircase, your goal is the top. But you don't focus on, like, the 100th step. You focus on the next one.
Guess what he's about to start talking about? Guess what chapter 11 is all about? You got it. Taking the next step and making the next step different. Now, unfortunately, I'm going to skip a lot of this, because Tim brought up a question one time. He said, if the goal is to give ourselves to Christ, if the goal is to become Christ, then what about our individuality? And I love that. Let me finish Mere Christianity with that. If you want to go back and read chapter 11 about the next steps, that's what chapter 11 is the next steps. But I want to get to that thought, because I think this is very important for us to understand. The only people who are truly themselves are the people who have given their all to Christ. So he picks it up here. But you must not imagine that the new men are, in the ordinary sense, all alike. A good deal of what I have been saying this last book might make you suppose that what was bound to be so, that is what was bound to be so. To become new men means losing what we now call ourselves. Out of ourselves into Christ we must go. His will is to become ours, and we are to think his thoughts, to have the mind of Christ, as the Bible says. And if Christ is one, and if he is thus, to be in us all, shall we not be exactly the same? It certainly sounds like it, but in fact, it is not so. It is difficult here to get a good illustration because, of course, no other two things are related to each other, just as the Creator is related to one of His creatures. But I will try two very imperfect illustrations. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Okay, pause before this dies. But I will try two very imperfect illustrations which may give a hint of the truth. Imagine a lot of people who have always lived in the dark. He borrowed this from Plato. It's brilliant. Imagine a lot of people who have always lived in the dark. You come and try to describe that to them what light is like. You might tell them that if they come into the light, that same light would fall on them all, and they would all reflect it and thus become what we call visible. It is not quite possible that they would imagine that, since they were all receiving the same light and all reacting to it in the same way. In other words, all reflecting it. They would all look alike. Whereas you and I know that the light will in fact bring out or show up how different they are. Or again, suppose a person who knew nothing. No, let's pause on that. I love the analogy, and it's obvious. If the lights in this chapel were dim, would we look more alike or less alike? We look more alike in the dark. But the moment the light increases, what happens to us? We see the differences and we relish in those differences. And I love the analogy. Added light into my life is not going to make me look like you. The added light will bring out the natural differences in me. I think that's a great analogy. Sitting in the dark, we would look very, very similar. In the light, we see that we're not. The other analogy, salt. Or again, suppose a person knew nothing about salt. You give him a pinch to taste and he experiences a particular strong, sharp taste. You then tell him that in your country, people use salt in all their cookery. Might he not reply, in that case, I suppose all your dishes taste exactly the same? Do you see the logic? Because the taste of that stuff you have just given me is so strong that it will kill the taste of everything else. But you and I know that the real effect of salt is exactly the opposite. So far from killing the taste of the egg and the tripe and the cabbage, it actually brings it out. They do not show their real taste till you have added the salt. Of course, as I warned you, this is not really a good illustration. I think it's pretty darn good. I don't know why he was so hard on himself, but I thought those were two great analogies. But he says, of course, I warned you that this is not really a good, very good illustration because you can, after all, kill other tastes by putting in too much salt. Whereas you cannot kill the taste of a human personality by putting in too much Christ. I am doing the best I can. Bless his heart. He did fantastically. But you get the idea? If I gave someone a pinch of salt, it would be overpowering to think that salt was added to everything that we taste. If I were to give you a pinch of Christ, it would be obvious for us to think that that pinch of Christ was overpower everything else. But that pinch of salt brings out the best of everything else. So he continues, and here's his point. It is something like that with Christ and us. The more we get what we now call ourselves out of the way and let him take us over, the more truly ourselves we become. There is so much of him that millions and millions of little Christs are all different. We'll still be too few to express him fully. He made them all. He invented, as an author invents characters in a novel, all the different men that you and I were intended to be. In that sense, our real selves are all waiting for him, for us in him. It is no good trying to be myself without him. The more I resist him and try to live on my own, the more I become dominated by my own heredity and upbringing and surroundings and natural desires. In fact, what I so proudly call myself becomes merely the meeting place for trains of events which I never started and which I cannot stop. What I call my wishes become merely the desires thrown up by my physical organism or pumped into me by other men's thoughts or even suggested to me by devils. Eggs and alcohol and a good night's sleep will be the real origins of what I flattered myself by regarding as my own highly personal and discriminating decision to make love to the girl opposite to me in their railway carriage. Propaganda will be the real origin of what I regard as my own personal political ideas. I am not, in my natural sense, nearly so much of a person as I like to believe. What most of us call me can be very easily explained. It is when I turn to Christ, when I give up myself, when I give myself up to his personality, that I first begin to have a real personality of my own. I just think we need to pause and think about that. What we call ourselves is usually what the world is telling us to be. And it's only when you give yourself to Christ that you are really you, and not what everyone else is trying to tell you to be. In the analogy of the tree of life, two groups of people got to the tree, but only one stayed. Who did not stay at the tree? Who didn't stay at the tree?
The shameful.
The ones who looked at other people. The people who didn't stay at the tree are the ones that were so worried about being what everyone else thought they should be. Now, who were they? Were they really being themselves? The only people that were themselves are the ones that did what? I don't care what you think. I care what he thinks. And only then do I take off everything they're telling me to be, and I get to be me. The only people who are truly themselves are the people who give themselves to Christ. At the beginning, I said there were personalities in God. I will go further now. There are no real personalities anywhere else. Until you have given up yourself to him, you will not have a real self. Sameness is to be found most among the most natural men, not among them those who surrender to Christ. How monotonously alike are all the great tyrants and conquerors have been. How gloriously different are the saints. But there must be a real giving up of the self. You must throw it away blindly, so to speak. Christ will indeed give you a real personality, but you must not go to him for the sake of that. As long as your own personality is what you are bothering about, you are not going to him at all. Remember the painter in Great Divorce, right? Remember the painter in the Great Divorce. As long as your own personality is what you are bothering about, you are not going to him at all. The very first step is to try to forget about the self altogether. Your real new self, which is Christ and also yours, and yours just because it is his, will not come as long as you are looking for it. It will come when you are looking for him. Does that sound strange? The same principle holds, you know, for more everyday matters. Even in social life, you will never make a good impression on other people until you stop thinking about what sort of impression you are making. Even in literature and art, no man who bothers about originality will ever be original. Whereas if you simply try to tell the truth without caring two pence how often it has been told before, you will 9 times out of 10 become original without having noticed it. The principle runs through all life from top to bottom. Give up yourself and you will find your real self. Loose your life and you will save it. Submit to death, death of your ambitions and favorite wishes every day, death of your whole body in the end. Submit with every fiber of your being and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will really be yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself, and you will find it in the long run. You will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ, and you will find him, and with him, everything else thrown in. Let me give you a second witness. Let me give you a non-C.S. Lewis, just so no one thinks I only quote C.S. Lewis. Let me give you a non-C.S. Lewis second witness. I love this parable, the parable of the wishing tree. I didn't fix this one. Sorry, this is small text. Into a room full of children at play walks their uncle. Laughing at their preoccupation with make-believe games, he asked them to go out to the massive banyan tree, which will grant them whatever they wish. The children rush out, stand under the branches of this huge tree that cover the sky, and ask for what all thrilled children crave, toys and candy. In a flash, they get what they want, but along with it comes an unexpected bonus, the built-in opposite of what they wished for. With toys, they get boredom. With candy, tummy aches. Sure that something has gone wrong with their wishing, the children ask for bigger toys and sweeter candy. The tree grants them their wishes, and along with them, bigger boredom and bigger tummy aches. Time passes. They are now young men and women, and their wishes change, for they know more. They ask for wealth, power, and fame. They get these. But they also get greed, insomnia, anxiety, and frustration. All this while one child has been able to move out of the room. Being lame, he was pushed down in the scramble, and when he dragged himself to the window, he was fixated watching his friends make their wishes, get them with their built-in opposites, and suffer, yet compulsively continuing to make more wishes. Riveted by this utterly engrossing scene of desire and its fruits, a profound swell of compassion welled up in the heart of this lame child, reaching out to his companions. In that process, he forgot to wish for anything for himself. And in that moment of spontaneous compassion for others, he sliced through the roots of the cosmic tree and becomes free. It's only when you live the life of Christ and give yourself to him that you truly become you. There's more I wanted to cover tonight, but we need to end. Shannon?
Sorry, you're making a lot of comments, but I wanted to just talk about this in the Book of Mormon for a second, because towards the end of the Book of Mormon in Helaman, it talks about how the people kept hiding things in the ground, and they could never find it again. And I think that
slippery.
Everything becomes slippery. And I think that was, I always thought that was weird as a kid, because I was like, what? Your stuff is slippery? But it's true, because, and then the opposite of that, I think of as the golden plates. You know, they're hid up unto the Lord. They're there for a purpose. And so when we give things to God like that, then that's when it becomes truly valuable, truly ours. But everything that we hold back is what we lose.
I leave you with my solemn testimony. I can't do it without him. And sometimes the biggest enemy to my progression is my own niceness. It's in moments of niceness that I stop yearning for him. May we never be content with our niceness. May we understand that the journey is to become what he is. And I cannot let my niceness actually interfere with that journey. May you discover your real selves. And the only time that you are truly you is when you have given you to him. Of that I solemnly testify in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.